October 22nd, 2019, VI 18 Vrindavan. We're studying 6th Canto, Chapter 16, the end of this chapter, text 50 to 65. And so the theme of these verses are our consciousness and our awareness. So we're going to be looking at what is perfection. And we're going to be looking at two kinds of substance, spiritual and illusory. So spiritual consciousness and illusory consciousness. So what is perfection in a general sense? And then another compare and contrast spiritual and illusory. So what is our consciousness and awareness? So one of the main points that we learn in the beginning of our study of our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy is that we are not the body, and that the main symptom of our existence is what's the main symptom of the existence of the soul?
Consciousness
or awareness. But there are different types of awareness, different levels of awareness. Thank you so much. Different types of awareness. So here we have Chitraketu, who achieves perfection. So in text 50, Samsitha, you are perfect. Please note that in text 65, we have Asvasya assuring of perfection. So that's also interesting. Text 65 says this, after thus instructing Chitraketu and assuring him of perfection in this way. In text 50 it says that now you are completely perfect. So those seem a little different. If I say you're completely perfect and I'm assuring you of perfection, assuring you of perfection sounds a little bit more future. So, any thoughts on that? So it sounds like in text 50 that it's present tense, and in text 65 it sounds like there's somewhat future tense.
Maybe it's perfect and non-perfect?
Probably. That perfection is dynamic. It's not just a matter of one becomes perfect and then one's business is finished, now I'm perfect. I mean, materially it's something like that. You know, you master something and then there's not that much more to do. I mean, I felt that way about being a teacher of children. I mean, you can always get better. It's not like you can't keep getting better. But after a while, I got bored. You know, after a while, it's like, okay, I know how to do this. I've mastered this. And now what? But spiritual life isn't like that. Right? Material life is like that. Like you become an expert cook, become an expert, whatever, mridanga player. You know, you can always get better. But after a while, once you're at a high level of mastery, after a while you're getting better as very small increments.
It's a law of diminishing returns.
It's a law of diminishing returns, thank you. So, yes, exactly. In the beginning, if you make this much effort, you get this much result. And as you become more and more of a master, you put this much effort, now you're getting this much result. Because you're already so close to the top. Again, it's not an absolute ceiling, you can always improve. But after a while, it gets boring. I assume that we work on things for more than one life. Like Prabhupada said, John Lennon had been a musician in a previous life. So we probably work on things for a while. But in spiritual life, it's not like that. It's not like, okay, now I'm Krishna conscious, now it's boring. So that there's perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. And we will see that Chitraketu does appear to have some maturing to do. This is interesting. As we go on to the next chapters, we'll find Prabhupada saying that the Lord wanted to take this jiva back to Godhead as fast as possible, which meant he wasn't going as fast as possible. Everybody follow this logic? So God comes to see him, Anantadev comes to see him, tells him, you're perfect, but you'll be perfect. You're perfect, you'll be perfect. This point is not unimportant, because I think it settles a lot of the confusion that we may have about Shastra, and maybe even in the people that we know, but personalities in Shastra who are perfect but are also still progressing. Both things. And of course, Krishna himself is always expanding as well. Krishna is not static. He's dynamic. Okay. Just putting that out there, because in the next chapters we will hit this, and at the end of this chapter there's this assurance of perfection. But let's put that aside right now and consider that at this point Chitraketu was perfect. Is that okay with everybody?
Yes.
So we can put that topic aside. So he's perfect. All right, let's look at this purport.
50,
yes. So in what ways is Chitraketu perfect? If you could tell me from the purport, what are the...
Spiritually educated.
All right.
Acting under the spiritual master.
Acting under the spiritual master. What else do you find it?
He's engaged in the service of the Lord.
He's able to see the Lord face to face.
Can see the Lord face to face. Did we talk about seeing the Lord face to face yesterday?
Yes.
Does everyone who sees the Lord face to face come in the category of perfect?
No.
No. We cannot say, it is not a correct conclusion, that if you see the Lord face to face, then you are perfect. That is not... Is that a true statement?
No.
Who saw the Lord face to face and was not perfect?
Kamsa.
Didn't we mention a whole lot of people yesterday? With some more. Kamsa, Daksha, who else?
Hiranyakashipu.
Who else?
Yeah,
remember we talked about, remember we told the story of the washerman?
Yes.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Hmm? Anukulena? Is that what you said? What? I lost you.
It is, no. Person has to be favorable to the Lord.
Oh, you're jumping back. Okay, you're getting back to the trunk here. I was out on a branch. So one of his perfection is he's seeing the Lord face to face, Anan Anukulena, he's favorable to the Lord. What else do we have here in this purport of his perfection?
He's
in his line of disciplic succession. What else do you find in this purport?
He understands the existence and how the Lord creates and maintains.
Okay, and we knew that from his prayers, where he talked about the Lord as the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. So he understands the relationship of the Lord to the creation and destruction.
And his senses are free from material contamination, so he's able to realize the Lord.
Okay. There's a bit of a controversy as to whether we see the Lord face to face with these eyes, or whether we see the Lord in the heart. And this controversy has been discussed by no less than Pipalaya Muni, as reported by Sanatana Goswami in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. where Pipalaya Muni says that because the eyes are controlled by the mind, that actually all seeing is in the mind, which is true. All sense perception is in the mind. All perception of pain and pleasure is in the mind. And hold that, because we're going to discuss that also with waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. So, but all sense perception is in the mind. No sense perception takes place in the senses themselves. The eyes do not see. Only the mind sees. The mind can see things without the eyes, but the eyes do not see anything without the mind. And we'll get back to this. That's a very important point in general, but we'll get back to that. But in this particular context, Pipalaya Muni said, because all sense perception happens within the mind, what you really want to do is see the Lord in your mind, not with your eyes. And I know at least of some devotees in ISKCON who say, we never see the Lord with our eyes. We only see the Lord with our mind. And then I said, well, what about when the Lord comes? Like Ananda Dev actually comes. Well, that's different, he said. Then the Lord comes, and the form of the Lord. I said, what about the deity? We're seeing the deity, we're seeing with our eyes. Can we not see the deity as Krishna? And then there's so many statements where Srila Prabhupada will talk about seeing the Lord face to face or eye to eye. Any thoughts about this?
About seeing the Lord face to face through the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Both. I have one example.
Okay.
I was in a class and one person was very challenging towards the speaker and was saying, only the first spiritual master who can see God face to face can be a spiritual master. And I had to translate that. I didn't want to, but I said. And then the devotee who was giving the class said, I can see the Lord's hand. And the person who was challenging just shut up.
Interesting.
And also the gopis were able to see the Lord, and although Krishna was not present, and they were enacting pastimes.
Okay.
Sometimes if one sees the Lord face to face, one gets stunned, cannot to understand what's happening. And the Lord can also...
The Lord can?
To disappear.
Well, he's going to do that at the end of this chapter also. Oh, very nice. Very nice. So he's saying there's three. One that's in the heart, one that's with the eyes, and one that's through the shastra. Very nice. Because many times Prabhupada will talk about seeing God face to face through the shastra. And like you were saying, Mahalakshmi, that this person said, I can see the hand of God. In other words, I can understand how Krishna is working, which is part of Chitrakeju's perfection, isn't it? Didn't we say that? His part of his perfection is he sees God in the creation and maintenance and destruction. So he's seeing the hand of the Lord. So here I think we have Chitraketu with all of these. Thank you for contributing that. That was quite wonderful. So the Chitraketu has all of these. He's meditating on the Lord in his heart. The Lord appears to him face to face. And through the Shastra, through his realization, he sees the Lord in the world. By the way, we should mention, and we studied this. Did I have any of you when I was teaching Second Canto? I don't think. When I taught Second Canto here, I don't think I had any of you. So in Second Canto, we were talking about the Chaturslok, and also the universal form is mentioned many times. You all remember that way back in the Second Canto. So how important it is to see the Lord in the world. That not just to see the Lord as a deity, not just to see the Lord in Vrindavan, but to also see the Lord in the world. So it's an important part of Chitraketu's perfection that he is understanding the Lord in the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the world. Yes?
So, seeing the Lord within the heart, so when we see how the Lord is moving things around, is this seen from within the heart?
It's not exactly the same, because seeing from within the heart is actually like transcendental television, Prabhupada says.
But there is some connection, but one understands, oh, this is being done by Krishna.
There's certainly a kind of seeing the Lord in our lives and in the world that we have through understanding the Shastra and through the practice of bhakti. Okay. We all experience this, I'm sure, yes? Yeah. Yes?
So that's related to...
Does everybody here have an experience of realizing how Krishna is acting in the world and in their lives? Some people are not responding to me at all, and I have no idea what your answer is. Yes? Yes?
Yes. Yes?
Yes? No. So you have no... Have you ever had any feeling, oh, Krishna is doing this in my life? No. Yes. Blank. Yes. And you?
Yeah, so many things.
Okay. I mean, it may be a very little thing. That's part of my job as the teacher. My job as the teacher is not to teach. My job as the teacher is that you learn. If I teach, you don't learn, I didn't teach. So if I ask something and people are just like this, then I will not go on. So please excuse me. That's my responsibility. It can be a very little thing. Like, I remember one day I was in Auckland and I was thinking I would really like some cashews. And I was walking back to my room, and there on the doorknob with the rubber band was a bag of cashews. So we have all had experiences like this, correct? You know, we have some thought, and then immediately Krishna does it. I mean, when I was first stayed in the temple, and, when I moved in permanently, and the Kishore Kishori were installed on Sunday, and then on Monday I went out at Harinam, and I didn't have good shoes for Harinam. It didn't work. And I was thinking, if I'm going to do this regularly, I need some good shoes. So my feet are small. They're small, they're short and wide. So it's hard for me to get shoes that fit. And I came back to the temple, and one devotee said, there's some shoes for you. And they fit perfectly. So things like this. And sometimes we see Krishna's hand in our lives in the difficult things. Yes? Something falls apart, something breaks, there's some catastrophe, and then you see, oh, that was Krishna's kindness on me. Sometimes it takes some years, and you look back and you say, whoa, Krishna really saved me. I was once invited to a temple to do some service, and I just had a lot of anxiety about it. I couldn't understand it. Why am I feeling so much anxiety about doing this service? And I just decided not to go. I said, I'm just not going to go. And 2 months later, the person who invited me died in a car accident. And I could understand that if I had gone, the person who invited me wouldn't have been there. Somebody else would have been there. And it wouldn't have been favorable. You understand? And I thought, oh, Krishna gave me this. Every time I thought about going, no, I don't want to go, I don't want to. And I was thinking, oh, Krishna saved me from some very difficult situation. So we see this in the bad things, we see it in the good things. Right? And then we can also see Krishna working in the world. It doesn't take much to just put your mind a little bit how Krishna's working in the world. We were talking about destruction and how Krishna's rotting you see our tree is rotting and the new plants are growing out of the rotting stump. Right? So this kind of seeing Krishna based on Shastra and based on our personal relationship with him, that's there. But then Krishna appearing in the heart or face to face. So Krishna appearing in the heart or face to face, and even understanding Krishna in our lives and in the world, Is this done just by our own intelligence and study of the Shastra?
No, Krishna's mercy.
It's also Krishna's mercy. And that's true even to understand that God is the creator, because there's so many people looking at the world. They're looking at the same world. They're not looking at a different world. And they don't see God the creator. I'm just thinking of an old story. Think about the cashews. So I was, this is an old story I had in some book at the Gurukul for our students. It was called The Atheist and the Orange. It was written by one woman. She and her husband were on a boat. And there was one gentleman sitting on the boat deck on the chairs with them, and he was arguing in favor of atheism. And he said, "How do you know that there's a God?" And she said, "Well, he reciprocates. You feel his presence." And he said, "Well, I don't believe this. I don't believe this at all." And she said, "All right." She said, "Suppose I ask God for something that is not so available on this boat." He said, "Okay." So she closes her eyes and she says, "My dear Lord, please give me an orange." And then this one of the workers on the boat walks by them and just simply puts an orange in her lap while she has her eyes closed in front of the atheist. And he was shocked.
True story.
But the point is that atheists see these things and still they don't necessarily accept. I think his heart was a little changed. Yes, exactly. Or I mean, I just remember I was trying to preach to my mother about we're not this body. And I said, just like when someone dies, the body is there and the soul is not there. She said, yes, that's right. And then she started saying that. She said, yes, just like I had been there, I was there when so-and-so died, the body was there, but the person wasn't there. And I'm like, wow. I said, so, mother, we are different from the body. She said, no, I don't believe that. yeah. There's some mercy involved here. There's definitely some mercy. And you know, Krishna is very intelligent and very clever. And I have one devotee, Rukmini, not my god sister, another Rukmini, I'm working on a book with her. And she was saying, Krishna is so clever that he can give the atheist arguments against his own existence. Imagine that. If I was so clever that I could convince you that I do not exist. So that is, Krishna is so clever. Huh? So therefore it's mercy also. Seeing the things in the world, seeing the way that Krishna is interacting personally in our lives, and of course getting a vision of the Lord in the heart, or the Lord showing up face to face, is mercy. And this happens also with the deity. So in our Hare Krishna movement, there's so many stories of people interacting with the deity where they really felt they were interacting with Krishna. Any of you have a story like that that you've heard from someone you'd like to share? Yes?
Once I was making turbans for Jagannath and Baldev, and usually my experience is like Baldev's turban, it makes like very quick, within some 20 minutes. But it takes almost 1.5 hours to make a Jagannath's turban. Although I keep all the items necessary there, it doesn't happen. And it was Ekadashi, I was feeling very weak. Then I told to Jagannath, if you don't cooperate with me, I'm not going to make turban for you, and tomorrow you won't wear a turban. And then when I started to put that everything, and within 10 minutes I could finish it.
Thank you. Anybody else have some story about themselves or somebody else that they'd like to share?
I have a lot of stories about this in my book.
Oh, there's so many. Actually, I have that book on my website. It's one of the most often downloaded items on my website is the stories of Nrisimhadeva in Mayapur. And the stories...
Huh? That's the small black book, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a small booklet. There's lots of stories of the Jagannath deities in Mayapur also. One devotee brought out an offering and then realized he hadn't brought Tulsi. And then, you know, he just offered obeisances. He thought, I can't leave the bogey here and go back to the temple. He was bringing on a bicycle. I think now they cook at that temple. But this is when they would bring the offerings from Mayapur. And he's just offering obeisances and praying, you know, imagining that there were tulsi leaves on the preps. And then later when he took the offerings off, there were tulsi leaves. When I first started cooking for the deities, I was told by Satyabhama, who's one of the first devotees, that when they were cooking, when they were first cooking for the deities, somebody made tomato chutney without peeling the tomatoes. And when they came back to the plate, all the peels were on the side. And the peels had been taken off. And there was another devotee who told me she was late to do her service for Jagannath Balaram and Subhadra. When she came, Balaram had come down two steps on the altar when she was late. Also, the many devotees had dreams about the deities. You know, I know one devotee who dreamt that like the deities kept telling her that the window was open and they were cold. And I know many, many stories of devotees who looked at the deities and actually saw the Lord. They didn't see a statue. You know, there are many, 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 many stories like that in ISKCON. And I know one story where several devotees had that experience simultaneously. So in New Mayapur, the pujari was pujari for, I don't know, for like 35 years. And Indrajumna Swami was visiting. He used to live in New Mayapur when he was in the Grihastha Ashram. So he came to see the deities, and so she and her husband were there with him in the temple room, and she's looking at the deities, and there she sees, you know, there's Radha and Krishna and Krishna and Balaram going to die. And so she didn't say anything to anyone. And about a week later, her husband said to her, when Indrajumna Swami was here and we were in front of the deities, was there anything different for you? And it turns out they had both actually seen the Lord. One of the strangest stories that I ever heard was from one of my godbrothers. This was with Laguna Beach Temple, where we had Panchatattva. So he was on the book distribution party to collect money. And the money that they were collecting from distributing books was going to be used to make a Gopurnima outfit for the deities. So the outfit was going to be red color. Anyway, he said that at this time, every day, many, many times a day for a year, he had been praying, I want to see God, I want to see God, I want to see God. Like the story I told of the washerman. You know, so I want to see God, I want to see God, I want to see God. So about a week before Gopurnima, he's in his room, and he looks, he's just looking at the wall in his room, and he sees the Panchatattva. And he sees them wearing this red outfit, this red Gopurnima outfit. And at first he just thought that he was in the temple room, seeing the deities. And then he realizes he's in his room. This is the Gopurnima outfit that hasn't been finished yet and offered yet. And the deities are wearing it in his room. And then he looks at them and he sees that they're alive. And then he said he felt so much fear. He said what he felt was fear. And he actually like, no, I don't want to see you. I don't want to see you. So there's also some... which is why it reminds me of the washerman story. That he was focused on, I want to see, I want to see, I want to see, I want to see. But he didn't have the right mood. And so he actually like kind of ran away. Krishna says, okay, here I am. And he's like, oh, I don't know if I want to see you. But we have these, there's so many stories. It's not just stories from long ago in the Shastra like Shakshi Gopal, but these are things happening in our ISKCON movement all the time. One of my good friends was telling me how she was in Mayapur and a certain devotee was leading a kirtan going around Radha Madhava's altar. And as she was following this devotee, she said all of the pictures came to life. Wow. As she was walking behind this, she said it was the only time she had that experience. Oh, I know, there's another story from Madrid. So there was one devotee there was talking about Krishna consciousness to these two young men, first time they had ever come to the temple. And there's a, I don't know if it's a mural on the wall or a painting, but Krishna Balaram and the cowherd voice is on the wall there. The front of that temple is a restaurant. And so this devotee was talking to these two young men, first time they'd been to a temple, about how Krishna, how God is a person, and how Krishna and Balaram are eating with their cowherd boyfriends like in this picture. And as he pointed to the picture and looked at it, all of a sudden the picture was alive and he was in the picture. And then when he came back to the room, these two young men looked at him and said, wow, this is real. How can I join? So they had the same experience as he, all three of them had the same experience. So, you know, sometimes this yes.
Yes, I was doing Sankirtan on the last Monday day, the day of Radharani's appearance day. So I went on Sankirtan for the whole day. I cannot distribute any book. So I came home, I was crying. I said, oh, Radharani, this appearance day, and I'm so ashamed I can't distribute a book. The day when I was about to go to sleep, a lady came and knocked the door. Said, I want, do you have Bhagavad Gita? She bought 10 Bhagavad Gita.
When you're going to sleep in your room?
Before going to bed, somebody, a lady came and knocked at the temple. Said, you need Bhagavad Gita. So went and said, I want 10.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What?
Maybe
Radharani came to buy the 10 Bhagavad Gita. So what's the difference between getting this mercy and revelation and just concocting with our mind? Any thoughts on this?
One is definitely purity.
One is definitely?
Purity. That's help us to move towards Krishna more. And envy, that is pushing us away from Krishna.
Okay, so we can tell the difference between whether we end up going towards or away from Krishna. Some other thoughts on the difference between revelation and just mental concoction?
One gives peace and the other gives satisfaction.
Okay.
One experience that when the devotee gets that revelation, they prefer to share it only to their close devotees. But when there is something like concoction, they try to spread it to everyone to prove their greatness or something.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? The difference between revelation by mercy, real revelation by mercy, and just imagination.
Revelation by mercy is beyond my capacity to do it. It's the Lord coming.
Okay. Other thoughts?
I guess it will leave some impression behind, like some transformation to the heart, which is real, not just a nice picture, a nice idea. It will leave something.
I think that's very profound. So it's not just the experience at the time. It's not just do I feel peace and happiness at the time and closer to Krishna, but do I continue to go closer? Do I continue to have some impression? Other thoughts? I mean, one is also based on Shastra. You know, I know of... I haven't met this person personally, and I hope I do not. But I know of someone who, you know, was a member of his kind. I'm pretty sure he was initiated by Srila Prabhupada. I'm not sure. Anyway, he went for some time off by himself and just chanted japa constantly. And then he claimed to have a vision of Govinda. But his way of explaining the nature of God and his way of explaining relationships with God, I wouldn't repeat it because it's actually kind of abominable, and I don't want the words to come out of my mouth. But the way that he explained it was just, it's just contrary to Shastra, it's contrary to Rupa Goswami's explanation of Rasa, it's contrary to Lord Chaitanya's explanation, it's contrary to the Bhagavatam. You know, he's basing it on one verse from the Bhagavatam to substantiate his view, but it's not consistent with the whole scope of Vaishnava philosophy. And he's got, I don't know how many followers, but he has some followers that he trains in his own system of spirituality, and it's actually very revolting. So I know one of his followers personally, And at one point he shared a video with me, and after looking at it for 2 minutes, I had to turn it off. I just said, I don't want to watch this. It's really just disgusting. It was revolting. So if somebody says that they have some sort of revelation about God, but it's not consistent with Guru and Sadhu and Shastra, then we can also understand that it's a concoction. Now, having said that, it's possible to substantiate almost anything from Shastra if you really want to. Like this man is taking one particular verse from the seventh canto and using that as a justification for his understanding. So the Christians call it the devil cites the scripture. And Prabhupada would say that also sometimes, the devil can cite scripture. So it is possible to use the words of scripture or Srila Prabhupada or the Acharyas to back up all kinds of things. But we're not talking about picking one verse from here. Or, you know, it's not like taking the paneer out of the sabji kind of thing. It's really getting the whole context of the Shastra, looking at Shastra as a whole. So our own realizations of Krishna and other people's realizations need to be understood in the whole context. Just something I should bring up. I hadn't planned to bring this up. For many years, I taught the sociology of religion at Bhaktivedanta College in Madhadesh. And many religions in the world are founded by a person who has some sort of revelation. You know, Muhammad goes out in the desert, I think, and is spoken to by Gabriel. And there's somebody, or, you know, whatever his name is, John Smith, I think, with the Book of Mormon. You know, there'll be some person who has some sort of revelatory experience that starts a new religion or a new religious or a new branch of a religion. And what tends to happen, what's called in sociological terms, the routinization of charisma. And charisma literally means like a gift from God. What happens after a while is the religion stops promoting the idea that people can have revelation. Because they want to systematize everything according to the revelations given to the founder. And so therefore they say, nobody else can have any revelations. Nobody else can have any spiritual experiences until after you die. Because they don't want anyone having any experiences that challenge whatever experiences founded their tradition. And so therefore you have like the Muslims who say that Muhammad is the seal of prophecy. Where they say Muhammad is the seal of prophecy. That there's no prophets that can come after him, that no one else. And you find in most religions this concept. And of course, we've had a tendency toward this in ISKCON, and what is that called? Ritvik, yes. So we have had the same sociological tendency has happened in our own movement. That, you know, Prabhupada is it, that's all. No, nobody else can be a pure devotee. Nobody else can have a revelation of God. Only Srila Prabhupada. Of course, some of the Ritviks will say, well, maybe someone in the future, maybe, we don't know. So that that's called soft Ritvik. But the hard Ritviks are forever. Srila Prabhupada's the only one who can be a pure devotee and the only one who can. But this tendency is very common in religions. They call it the routinization of charisma. To say, our founder's revelation, that's it, and spiritual ecstasy, spiritual revelation is now cut off from everybody else. And in this way, they make some sort of system that they can control. So it's quite common.
Very sad.
It is quite sad, but it is also understandable.
They don't have sahayas or something.
Or whatever, some kind of deviation. You know, because, I mean, and we have had in ISKCON people who say all kinds of strange things, like this one person who started his own movement that I'm aware of. But, I mean, I know of people who say, that's how we lost the temple in Manhattan. We had the person in charge that I had a dream where Prabhupada told me to sell the temple. So that was how we lost the 55th Street Temple. So, you know, there is a problem like that. It's not that there isn't a potential for problems that somebody can, you know. I just met someone in London who said his friend is convinced that Prabhupada wants him to root out all corruption in ISKCON. I said, how does he know that Prabhupada gave him that job? Well, he's just convinced Prabhupada gave him that job. How does he know? So there is a danger with people saying, I've seen God, and God spoke to me, or I've seen Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada spoke to me, and this is my instruction, and this is what we're supposed to do. Am I, this is right, yes? We have this. We definitely have this. We have this with one devotee named Goridas Pandit in ISKCON. But anyway, we have this problem, which is why religious organizations sometimes just say, okay, nobody can have any, we will not accept anybody having any vision of God or having any vision of the divine.
So how can we find balance amongst
this? Therefore I say that things have to be within the context of Guru Sadhu and Shastra. If somebody says, I had a dream of Prabhupada, you know, we should balance this and look at, say, well, what are Prabhupada's instructions in general? This is why we have the GBC and not just one acharya. You know, Srila Prabhupada also set up ISKCON so we wouldn't have one person claiming, you know, now I've seen Krishna, now I've seen Lord Chaitanya, and we're going to go in this direction. But in order to have a living spiritual movement where we do accept that our members are going to have darshan of the Lord, then we do have some risk that we can introduce deviations with people having false darshans and false whatever. So there is, that risk is there. It's not that it's not there. But if you try to eliminate this risk by saying, you know, all realization and all revelation is bogus, the only person who has any realization is Prabhupada, then you risk killing the whole thing. You know, then it becomes nothing. And we do have that tendency also, even without it being firm Ritvik, we do have some tendency of Prabhupada's the only pure devotee. There's definitely a move in that direction, even if it's not called Ritvik. Have you all experienced this?
Yes.
You know, that
lack of faith in our leaders.
Yeah, that putting Prabhupada at the center translates into Prabhupada's the only one who could see Krishna face to face at every time, and that will never happen to anyone else in our movement. You know, and anyone who comes to that platform is bogus. So it's something that we also deal with as an institution. This kind of question. I don't think we can resolve this. I'm not going to give you, like, this is how to resolve this issue. I'm simply telling you that it's an issue.
If one has a kind of revelation as the ones we heard right now, but one doesn't realize the message of the dream or darshan, but years after, is it still a revelation or is how we are?
Of course, many things are understood years later or understood more in depth. I think that's true in spiritual life in general. Just like what you were pointing out about destruction. And I was thinking, you know, how many times have I read that purport? And I was specifically reading that purport to prepare for a class, which is a much more in-depth focused kind of reading. And I still missed it. I just missed it. It just didn't register. So, you know, sometimes we have that we go, I think many times perhaps, that we sometimes years later you're like, oh, now I understand what I read in the Chaitanya Charitamrita 5 years ago. Now I understand that class. Yes. But we do have Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, and we have Sadhu also means the sadhus of our movement, our Sangha, our community of devotees, that we want to encourage the fact that people are going to have sakshat darshan, that people are going to have revelation of Krishna in their life, Krishna in the heart, and Krishna face to face. At the same time, we want things to be presented properly so that we don't have a deviation. Okay, going on to facets of consciousness. So this section is particularly about different types of consciousness. So here we have consciousness of where we're seeing the Lord. And this seeing of the Lord takes place at what's often called Turiya, or the fourth level of consciousness. And there's a lot in this section about dreaming, sleeping, deep sleep dreaming, and wakefulness. And we have in text 54, Srila Prabhupada making the point in the purport, which he makes frequently, that our waking state is also a dream. Our waking state is also a dream. Right? Prabhupada says in purport 53-54, there may be many mountains, rivers, trees, bees, tigers, and snakes that are situated far away, but in a dream one may imagine them to be nearby. Similarly, as one has subtle dreams at night, when the living entity is awake, he lives in gross dreams of nation, community, society, possessions, skyscrapers, bank balance, position, and honor. And here Krishna is saying that he's the director of these states. This particular topic especially fascinating . There's some indication that whenever we have an experience of seeing the Lord, whether it's seeing the Lord working in our lives by we do the turban in 10 minutes, or some lady knocks on our door as we're falling asleep, or there's a bag of cashews on my doorknob. When it's those experiences, or we get a vision of the Lord in the heart, or we have some amazing actual seeing the Lord in painting, or in the deity, where the painting of the deity becomes alive, in all of those cases, we're actually operating from a different level of consciousness. We are not in normal waking consciousness. And there's many, many statements throughout the Shastra of great devotees who are constantly in a state of trance. Now, we may think of a state of trance as kind of like this. You know, and there's some indication, of course, with Astanga Yoga of samadhi being like that. We have Shambhukarishi who didn't hear Parikit, we have Indrajumna who didn't hear the sage, I forget his name. And we have Lord Shiva who didn't hear Daksha. So we have these kind of examples. But there is also a different state of consciousness in which one can function in the world, but is not in the waking consciousness. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is said to have three states of awareness: external, internal, and mixed. Right? And when he was in external consciousness, he's dealing with the world. When he's in internal, his body would often change, right? His joints would become loose, or they'd go in like a turtle, and he had no awareness of what was going on. And then midst, he was aware of what was going on, but he would be speaking about Krishna. But even in his external consciousness, Mahaprabhu was not experiencing our normal wakefulness, because our normal wakefulness is also a kind of sleeping state. Now, just to confuse all of this further, devotees are very prone to seeing the Lord in dreams. Pure devotees will often see the Lord in dreams. Prabhupada comments about Madhavendra Puri and the Brahmana who found the sweet rice behind Shirdi Court, Gopinath's foot, that both of these persons were on an equal level of bhakti because they both saw the Lord in dreams. Now, why would the Lord come in dreams instead of in wakefulness? Because in dreams, dreams are more subtle. And so, in one sense, we might think of deep sleep as the most ignorance, and dreams as a little less ignorance, and wakefulness as the closest to spirituality. But yet we find that the Lord is more apt to appear in a dream than in an awakened state to people, which shows that we're more open to the spiritual realm in a dream. And the pratyahara of Astanga Yoga is compared to deep sleep. So that's just to confuse everybody. To deep sleep, but with control over the intelligence.
With control over the intelligence.
Yes. Okay. So let's think of different categories here. So if we're going to think what's temporary, think which ones are temporary, we could think awareness of God. Knowledge of self. Any other categories? Some more motivation.
What is that one?
Motivation. So in transcendental consciousness, is that, would that be temporary or not? But sometimes it is. Sometimes one has transcendental consciousness very fleetingly. Isn't it?
I don't understand.
Just like this morning that one devotee said in the class, how the devotee said to Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. And Prabhupada said, no, you're always in Maya. Sometimes you fall into Krishna. So we can have, as conditioned souls, a very temporary glimpse of transcendental consciousness, isn't it? Now we're touching the eternal, but we're touching it temporarily. What about awareness of God? What's our awareness of God in transcendental consciousness?
It can range from partial to full.
It can range from partial to full, yeah. It can be just, oh, Krishna helped me do the turban nicely. It can be, you know, Krishna's the light of the sun. It could be Brahman, it could be Paramatma, it could be full-on Bhagavan, it could be full-on Bhagavan's Leela. What about in waking, what's our awareness of God?
Full.
Full awareness of God in waking?
In knowledge.
Full awareness of God in waking? Is everybody who's in waking consciousness fully aware of God?
No.
What kind of awareness of God do people have in waking consciousness?
The external
world. Generally, they're aware of the external world and not so much of God at all. They might be aware of God somewhat intellectually, in a religious way, but not so much aware of God. What about in dreaming? How much awareness of God in dreaming? In a dream state. How much awareness of God is there in a dream state?
Generally not so much.
You know, occasionally God appears in a dream, but generally in a dream state, there's not even so much awareness of the external world. And what about in deep sleep?
No.
In deep sleep, there doesn't seem to be awareness of anything. But the Bhagavatam says we still have awareness of our existence because after deep sleep we will say, I slept very well. So there's some concept of an I. So how do we identify the self in transcendental consciousness?
At
as a soul. And we may identify the self as a servant of God, or even in a particular lasa. How do we identify? What's our awareness of ourself in a waking state? How do we identify ourselves? In terms of the body, our race, our gender, our age, our marital status, our nationality, right? Our occupation, different family relationships. How do we identify the self in a dream state?
Could be anything.
Could be anything.
Yeah. Could be anything. What? I am a bird flying.
I'm a bird flying in the sky. I mean, generally when I dream, I have the same bodily identity that I do in my waking state. But I have flown around in my dreams.
Yeah.
I've definitely been flying in my dreams. And I was couldn't do it when I woke up. What about deep sleep? What's our knowledge of ourself?
Nil.
Pretty close to nil. What about our awareness of body? In a transcendental state, how much are we aware of the body?
No.
Very little. Very little, if anything. In waking state?
Very conscious.
It's our primary consciousness, isn't it? Our main awareness is of the body and the mind, our physical and mental state. What about in dreaming? Yeah, I mean, I basically lose awareness of my gross body when I'm sleeping. And in deep sleep? Not awareness of it at all. What's the motivation in transcendental consciousness?
Pleasing Krishna.
Love of Krishna. And in waking?
Sense gratification.
To satisfy the body, the bodily demands. In dreaming?
To get away from that tiger.
To get away from the tiger, what were you going to say? And in deep sleep?
Just to carry on sleeping.
Just to carry on sleeping. So why is it that the scriptures consistently refer to everything other than transcendental consciousness as a kind of dreaming? So they're distinguishing between these. There's a distinguishment. There's deep sleep, dreaming, wakefulness, and transcendence. But at the same time, waking is often compared to a kind of dream. All three of those are compared to a kind of dream.
Because of its temporary nature.
Okay. Anything else?
Because in all stages we forget about God.
Because in all of them we're forgetting about God.
And all our body based on the bodily concept.
Well, we find that the bodily concept was most active in the waking state. It's an illusion, and a dream is obviously an illusion. By the way, how do I know that a dream is an illusion?
When I awake, it's no longer there, the tiger or whatever.
Okay, but that happens even like those people.
Yeah.
Now they're not there anymore. But yet I accept that those people were actually walking there. That burfi you gave me at lunch, it's not here anymore, but I accept that I ate it. And I've never dreamt of a tiger, bless you. I've dreamt of people with guns chasing me, but not tigers. So why would we say that our waking state is also a dream?
Because
we're not happy. Well, how do I know that dreams are not real? You said they're temporary, but how else? We're all convinced that dreams are not real. I don't think we were convinced as children. I think when we were little children, we thought that dreams were real. And our parents kept telling us, it's just a dream, it's just a dream.
They're real dreams.
But why do we make this distinction between waking and dream, that we think our waking consciousness is real and our dream is not real?
Because
they don't match. They our activities in a dream are contrary to the often as in awakening.
Awakening. So why don't we assume that the dream is more real than the waking? Yes?
If dream is not true, then how the previous acharyas should get instructed by their gurus to have some answer?
Yes, that is a very good point. Which I've already brought up as something mysterious. That it very much appears to us that wakefulness is the closest to spiritual consciousness. Dreams are further away, and deep sleep is even further away. And Shastra gives two different ways of looking at it. Sometimes in Shastra, deep sleep is considered closest to spirituality,
yeah.
And sometimes wakefulness is considered closest to spirituality. So there's some confusion there. It does appear to be that the dreaming state puts us more in touch with the subtle realm than the waking state. And this could be something like we consider gross matter to be more real than subtle matter. But actually, subtle matter is more real. So we tend to have it backwards.
In which way subtle matter is more real?
It's the basis of gross matter. And it persists. Like we carry our subtle body from one life to another. That stays with us a lot longer than our gross body. But it's the basis. The subtle is the basis of the gross. And the spiritual is the most subtle. Yeah?
When I read the Bible, there's a story of Joseph who dreamed selling cows.
Yes.
And selling cows are lean. And it was interpreted that there are 7 years
of good years and 7 bad years, yes.
Yeah.
So we do have many, many, many examples in our scriptures of great devotees who have spiritual realizations in dreams that they don't have in waking life. That's Madhavendra Puri kept seeing the Lord in dreams rather than in waking life. And again, Prabhupada said that he and the Brahman were on the same level. But still, generally in the scripture, a dream is the metaphor for an illusion. But again, why do we accept that my waking life is more real than a dream?
Maybe in the waking state we can make conscious choices.
I think I make conscious choices in a dream. Feels like it to me in the dream. I really have no idea if the choices I make in a dream are dictated by some higher force or if I'm making those choices. I don't know, but in the dream I feel like I'm choosing.
Waking state, what we were doing, but we cannot continue our dream.
Generally, although sometimes dreams continue, but I think that's one thing, is that the dream doesn't continue, whereas in the waking state it does. There is some continuation. But that is mostly evidenced, I would say, by other people. Now, my own conclusion is it's based mostly on a collective understanding. So everyone here would agree that we had a class this morning. So because everybody here agrees, I consider that it actually happened. Whereas if I dreamt that we had a class at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I said to all of you, I had a dream that we had a class at 1 o'clock in the morning, the rest of you would say, well, I wasn't here at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then I would decide on the basis of that, that my dream didn't actually. So that's my own conclusion, that it's mostly a collective experience. That because other people are verifying, when you're saying there's some continuation, there's a continuation with other people that will say, okay, we did this with you yesterday. Because I do have some dreams that continue. I've had recurring dreams and dreams that continue. I don't even remember all of my dreams, so how do I know to what extent they continue, bless you, or not? But we get verification from others. You know, if I say I had lunch upstairs, you'll all agree. But if I say I ate breakfast with all of you, you wouldn't agree. You'd say, no, I wasn't there with you for breakfast. So, you know, if I say, I had a dream that I invited you to my room for prasadam, which would be a neat trick where I'm staying right now. But if you didn't, if you said, well, I never went to your room for prasadam. So I see it more like that, that this is, it's like a collective imagination. So we think that it's real. And my comparison to that would be a computer game. A computer game. Computer game, like a video game, where you have many different players, they're all in the same game, and they can be in different, you're all familiar with computer games?
Yeah, from the children.
From the children, yeah, I've never played one, but I've watched people play them, and people will be in different parts of the world. You can have one person in Korea, and one person in Russia, and one person in Brazil, and they're all on the same game at the same time, and they have a character in the game. And the characters, this is how my niece met her husband. They were playing characters in the game. So, you know, my character in the game is talking to your character in the game. And the people will talk about the game. I've seen kids, when they're off the computer, they're talking to each other about the game that they played on the computer, where they were assuming a different body. They had another body. You can, you know, have a purple body or a green body, or you can choose your gender and your height and your muscles and your everything. You create your own body, and then you... So this is, it's a shared reality. But it's all an illusion. It's all an illusion. And something's happening in the video game. Something's happening. What's happening? What's actually happening?
The people are... pressing keys.
Okay, people are pressing keys. What else is actually happening?
The game is moving forward by the imagination of the...
No, what's actually happening?
Interaction. There's some internet connection.
There's internet connection, so there's some electricity. What else is actually happening?
Well, these people have some exchange. Maybe they like someone, don't like someone.
So there's some emotional exchange going on. What else is happening?
They really get connected to that character.
Well, no, that's an illusion. But what is really happening?
They spend time there.
They're spending time there. What else is really happening?
They're anxious to win.
Well,
that's an illusion.
Well, as you mentioned, after the game, they are still influenced by what happened.
Yes.
They maybe feel good or bad in the game. Or...
So there's this emotion. There's this illusion of rasa, but that's an illusion. If there wasn't an illusion of rasa, they wouldn't play it. That's what's driving them. So we talked about electricity, we talked about the keys, like the metal and the plastic of the machines. There's ones and zeros. Right? There's the computer program, which is in some computer language, Fortran or BASIC or some other language. And then ultimately there's ones and zeros. So that's what's really happening. What's really happening is there's ones and zeros, or there's some computer language, there's metal and plastic, there's electricity. That's what's really happening. But what appears to be happening is that I'm such and such character, and I'm winning something, or I'm losing something. So how is that just like our waking state?
Well, something is happening, but we're in the illusion as to what it really is.
Yes. Something is happening, but we are in illusion as to what it really is. When the people are playing the computer game, they're not aware, I'm just manipulating ones and zeros using electricity and metal and plastic. They're thinking, you know, I'm the great hero, Wooshy Boosh, and I'm killing the Ashigash. That's what they're thinking is happening, and you're on my team, and we're going together, and we're winning the gold, and we're winning the weapons, and... I've seen people sell their characters for like thousands of dollars, by the way. Just by the way. So that's what they're thinking. And I've even heard people talk to each other by the names of their characters. You know, oh, hail, purple flame. And you're like, what? Oh, Mother Mila, that's his name in the game. And I'm like, oh. Hare Krishna. So that's what we're doing here, You know, we're really just the observer. I mean, there's a lot of verses in this chapter like that, that we're just the observer. We're just the observer, and we're identifying with our character in the game.
We are the observer after Krishna sees.
We are the, well, that is also nicely explained here, how that Krishna is the observer. Right? That was in text 56. If the living entity is different from the super soul, how can he remember the activities of dreams? That we, the soul, are the observer along with God of both our dreaming and waking state. So, why don't you write down 2 or 3 sentences, just each of you on your own, as to why our waking state of consciousness is consistently in the Shastra compared to a dream. 2 or 3 sentences. Okay, we have something very interesting here in text 55. The purport. Thus, due to Brahman, even while sleeping, the living entity can enjoy. The Lord says that Brahman, that Paramatma, and that Bhagavan are I myself. This is noted by Srila Jiva Goswami in his Krama Sandarbha. So, even in sleeping condition, the living entity can enjoy. It is possible, therefore, for spiritually awakened consciousness to be prevalent while waking, while sleeping, and while dreaming. Anybody want to explain what that means? That spiritual consciousness can be existing even while a person is awake, dreaming, or asleep.
Well, if someone is on such a high spiritual level that he actually identifies with the soul, he's always in that stage of consciousness, even when the body needs rest and lays down, the person still may remain in some level of consciousness.
Yes.
You do identification as the soul.
Like Arjuna, when he was living in Dwarka, from his body, the names of Krishna were coming up.
Mm.
Yeah, like Srila Prabhupada, I don't remember the exact detail, but Srila Kirti Prabhupada told stories how Prabhupada was laying down and actually was not, probably immediately responded to something he was thinking.
Yes.
Prabhupada was laying there, but actually not.
Right, Prabhupada does say that it's not that those in the mode of goodness or those in transcendental consciousness do not dream, but it's they're not awake, dreaming, or asleep like an ordinary conditioned soul. They don't, you know, apparently they have waking consciousness, dreaming, and deep sleep, but it's not really the same at all. They always have an awareness of themselves as separate from the body and separate from the world. Again, we have Lord Chaitanya, who, as acting as a devotee, exhibited this to some extent. Now, we have a lot of verses here, and I hope that most of you notice this, that really sound like we're the same as God. Did a lot of you notice that, going through this section? That it really sounds like Ananta Deva is saying, you know, you and I are one. Did you notice this or not? No? Yes.
Because the living entity is Brahmin in quality. That's why they can remember past activities of the dream.
Right, but it's Srila Prabhupada who's putting that into the translation.
Yes.
Yes, Prabhupada is saying one in quality. Sometimes that's there in the Sanskrit, but generally it's not. So, in most of the cases in these verses, it's explaining that we are one with the Lord. And so the Mayavadis will read verses like this from the Bhagavatam and decide that, well, that means that we are God. Well, that we are God in every respect. And if we go back a bit to 52, Prabhupada starts off saying that the Mayavada philosophy sees everything as equal in quality, with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and therefore sees everything as worshipable, which turns everyone towards atheism. And Prabhupada's quoting Mayate Tamidam Sarvam from the Bhagavad Gita. Everything is in me, but I am not in them. Of course, I always like to tell this story that this is one of the verses I taught the children. Mayate Tamidam Sarvam Jagadavyakti Murti Namastani Sarabhutani Nachaham Te Subhasitaha. That by me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And one year when I would teach that verse every year, but one year when I taught it, after the Bhagavad Gita class, there was a break time, and I heard two of the six-year-old children talking on the break, and they said, Mother Amila doesn't understand Krishna consciousness, because she was teaching us that Krishna is not in everything. But I know Krishna is in everyone's heart. She was saying, all beings are in me, but I am not in them. And that's wrong. She was wrong. So, the Mayavadis say that because Krishna is in everything and everything is in him, that therefore everything is equally worshipable. Which, of course, nobody can live like that. You wouldn't be able to walk.
Not to breathe.
You couldn't breathe, you couldn't walk, you certainly couldn't use the toilet. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, it just, you can't function if you're thinking everything is God in a worshipful sense. So it's a philosophy that's not a practical philosophy, it's not a livable philosophy. And I would say that one of the main evidences that a philosophy is wrong is that you can't live it. You know, how do you tell if philosophy is wrong? Which goes back kind of to our discussion this morning about what is religion, what is real religion. If you've got the philosophy is wrong, you can't do it. You can't live a philosophy that everything is equally God. Not in any kind of real sense. You know, we used to have this joke that you tell the Mayavadi, you know, why don't you wear a ball of cotton wool instead of a shirt? You know, it's pour your water on the muddy ground instead of in a mud pot. You know, it's just, you can't live that way. Nor can you really live a philosophy where God is completely separate from the world and separate from us. That's also not a very livable philosophy, but perhaps a little bit more so than the other. So Srila Prabhupada in text 57 is again getting into the Mayavada interpretation. And the reason Prabhupada's bringing this up is that these verses in the Bhagavatam could definitely be interpreted impersonally. They could definitely be interpreted in an impersonal way. So that's why Srila Prabhupada is picking on impersonalism here in this section. And what is the example that he's giving here in the purport?
As soon as the living entity forgets his constitutional position and endeavors as to become one with God.
No, he's giving an example. He's giving a metaphor.
Sunshine.
Sun in the sunshine. So, I'd like us to do in this late afternoon when people are feeling sleepy is we're going to get out our creative side. You can just draw on the back to save paper. And I'd like you on one half of this to draw the Vaishnava understanding of the sun and the sunshine, and the other half, the Mayavadi idea of the sun and the sunshine. One of our Vaishnava view of sun and sunshine, and the other is a Mayavada view
Sunday sometime. And we'll share that. So I got 7 minutes.
And who does which?
You make up your side. Pretend that you're going to give a class to 5-year-olds. Okay? Pretend you're going to explain this concept to a bunch of 5-year-olds. And I want you to draw a picture of sun and sunshine, the one that shows our Vaishnava philosophy and one that shows my Vada philosophy. You know, if you don't, if you can't understand the other side, it's very hard to defeat them. I'm going to give you a better paper than that. Here, you can have a better paper. That was hard to use. I'm going to give you some pens here. Pretend you're going to give a class to 5-year-old children. Please put away your books and phones. Please put away your books and phones. Please put away your books and phones.
We have to paint.
You just be creative. Here, let me give you a better paper. Put away your books and phones, please. Sun and sunshine from a Vaishnava. Put away your books and phones, please. Please put away your books and phones. Please put away your books and phones. Please put away your books and phones. Thank you. Please put away your books and phones. Please take your book and put it away and put your phone away. Please. Thank you. Put your book away. Please. Put your book away. Put your book away. Put your phones away. Put your book away. Put your book away. Put your phones away. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Pretend you're going to teach some children about the difference between the Vaishnava perspective and the Mayavada perspective using the sun and the sunshine, and draw them some pictures.
Is it the same?
They say the same, and they don't have existence. Once it's merged, they don't have any existence.
Any separate existence. Thank you. Okay?
We need 2 though.
You have 2? Okay. Whoa, all right.
This is the sun and the rays. They're separate, you can see.
Okay.
And then this is this is my body.
So, the Vaishnavas the Vaishnava is in the house and he says, oh, the sun has come into the house, and he means the sun rays. But the Mayavadi says, oh, I'm in the house and the sun has come, and actually the sun has come.
Very nice, thank you. Okay, this group here. You have to stand up.
You play.
There is a sun, and sunshine comes directly to the vent. It goes like a cloud. When there is obstacle like clouds, my body is this one cactus. My body is a cactus. They say we are independent from the sun.
Oh.
And still we can grow.
They're saying we can grow independently.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But they grow like a cactus.
They can only grow like a cactus. Okay, thank you. Okay. Oh, I'll show it to everybody else also. Yes, can you explain?
Usually,
it's the measure
and
under different situation. I'm saying that sunshine is there and receiving
the sunshine is dropping on
you,
sunshine. Whereas
Mayavadi
is nothing again.
Oh, you're
another
with another.
It's just the philosophy. So the sunshine, sun is there. That's why the sunshine is the different than the sun. But at the same time, sunshine is coming from the sun. So sun is there, that's why we are getting sunshine. So similarly, the devotee believes that Krishna is there, that's why all these the things we are having, we are also part of parcel of Krishna. So in a way, they get an example. So maybe we didn't see the God. So maybe it's there or not, or somebody may be making us stupid by writing some books, and we don't know what is the truth. So that's why we can understand, devotees can understand by this example. But the Mayavadis, they just worship Nirakara and they think they are there, but they come from nothing. So even the ashes also doesn't come from nothing. They
yes.
We need to burn some wood or something.
Mm.
So this is the Mayavadi philosophy in my understanding.
Thank you very much. Okay, just a couple of very quick last points here. If we look at text 60, 60. So here the Lord is giving an example of a family. He gives an example of a husband and wife who marry with the idea that they're going to increase their happiness and decrease their distress by joining together, but it doesn't work. Our happiness and distress is already fixed. And in fact, simply they increase their unhappiness. So this is also one of the evidences that our waking state is like a dream, that it's not reality. Because if it was reality, it would have a real effect. The fact that our actions in our waking state don't produce what we think they're going to produce. And I told this story many times, that once on a fast day, I was fasting from food and water, and I took a little rest, and in my dream, I dreamt I was eating. I remember I was eating for chorus. And then I dreamt I was drinking water, because I was fasting from water, and I was drinking a cup of water, then I was drinking another cup of water, then I was drinking another cup of water, and another cup of water, and finally in my dream, I took the jug of water, and I started pouring the jug of water in my mouth. And then in the dream, I thought, something's funny here. Why am I still thirsty? So it wasn't real. It didn't quench my thirst, although I was drinking so much water and eating so much food in my dream. So in the same way, in our material life, we try to become happy, and it doesn't work. In fact, we get, as Prahlad Maharaj says in the seventh canto, we inevitably get the opposite results of that we desire. In leadership, they call it the law of unintended consequences. That we think we're going to achieve one thing and we achieve the opposite. So I just end with some very practical examples of this. So in the United States, they wanted to increase the health care for people who are deaf or hearing impaired. So they passed a law that doctors had to provide a sign language interpreter for deaf people or hearing impaired people, but they didn't provide the funds. So the doctors had to pay for the interpreter, which was very expensive. So it's very easy to know who's deaf when they're making an appointment. And so they just told the deaf patients, we have no available appointments. Because the doctors didn't want to spend the extra money for the sign language interpreter. So then hearing impaired people got no medical care at all. So they went from getting medical care where they didn't have an interpreter to no medical care. Another really good example is birth control and abortion. So the idea was, well, there are children who are born who are not wanted. They're born outside of marriage, or they're born, nobody wants them, they're abused. So if we develop birth control and we make abortion available, then people will avoid or they'll kill the babies that they don't want, and then the only babies that will be born are babies that people want. Does that make logical sense to everybody? That's logical, right? Isn't that logical? It makes perfect sense. It's a very logical idea. But exactly the opposite happened. So like in America, in 1960, 4% of children were born outside of marriage. Today it's 40%. And the cases of child abuse and child neglect are also increasing. So they thought they were going to solve the problem, but they made the problem worse. Another example, these are all American examples, but there are other examples you can find all over the world, was the government wanted to protect endangered species of animals. You've heard this, endangered species?
Yes.
Of animals? So most of these animals have a certain habitat where they live. So the government would make a law that if you have property that has a habitat for endangered species, you cannot build on that property. Does everybody understand this?
Yes.
Okay, but there was a problem. First they would declare a species endangered, and then they would figure out what habitat was needed for that species. And there was a gap of a few months. So they would say, you know, the red spotted owl is endangered, nobody can kill it, nobody can shoot it, whatever. And then they say, oh, the red spotted owl, it needs such and such trees. So if you have these trees on your property, you cannot build on your property. So there were organizations that would keep track of these government rules. And they would be ahead of the government. So as soon as an animal was declared endangered, they would quickly figure out what kind of environment did that animal need. And they would tell landowners, if you have this kind of environment, you're not going to be able to build starting in 4 months. So what the landowners would do is they would quickly destroy the environment.
Oh.
And so if they had the right kind of trees for this endangered owl, they would cut down all those trees. If they had the right kind of wetland, they would fill the land. So the government rules ended up decreasing the amount of suitable land available for endangered species instead of increasing it. And I could give you many, 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 many examples of something. This is something I teach about in a policy, how to develop policies. But this law of unintended consequences is very prevalent in this world. And Prahlad Maharaj said people inevitably get a result opposite to that which they desire. And this is also being brought up particularly in text 60. And this fact that we get the opposite result to that which we desire is a strong evidence for the illusory nature of non-transcendent consciousness. That if our consciousness is of illusion rather than reality, naturally we would get a different result than we desire. If I see things differently than as they are, like you said, we see it, but we don't see it for what it is. Just like Duryodhana, he saw water and thought it was land, he saw land and thought it was water. If you see things wrongly, the result you get is the opposite to the result that you think you're going to get. And if you see things rightly, you get the result that you expect to get. Okay, so tomorrow.